hppodcraft.com.
Miss Garvis had concluded by suggesting that I perhaps ought to pay my first visit at once. I went home to lunch, then I set out. Among the first things I discovered were that Sally kept every single door in the house locked, and that the remains of the tea I had taken with her weeks before still lingered in the sitting room. Not, mercifully, the food, but the plates and cups and genteel little knives and the teapot with leaves and liquor at the bottom of it.
Ew.
Hello, folks. That was Rachel Lackey reading an excerpt from The School Friend by Robert Aichman. This is the second part of our long-running two-part series on this story. Thank you for sticking with us here on Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
And I'm Chris Lackey. We're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon. Folks, it's October.
Yes!
How did we miss that? October.
I don't know. A lot of folks are angling for the spot. Robert Block does not like challengers, you know. I was going to do a Jeff C. Cartober, but I got a cease and desist from Robert Block's ghost.
Oh,
true,
whoa.
Jeff. That's what happened.
Wow.
I am making this torture joke only so that I can mention that Cold Spell, The Halloween Curse of Winterhill by Jeff C. Carter is available now, folks.
Ah, yes.
New book that he's written. When a freak blizzard cantles trick-or-treating, based on a true event, a Halloween-obsessed nerd and his friends break the rules and go out only to discover that a terrible curse has befallen their town. Ooh. Cold Spell is a fun, fast-paced story of friendship and supernatural adventure that will appeal to fans of Hocus Pocus, Goosebumps, and anyone who believes that there is magic just beyond the red and orange-veiled woods.
Yeah.
After you've had your middle schoolers read Cold Hand and Mine by Aichman. I think Chris specifically recommended that you have your children read Swords. He said that story's good for your sixth graders, right? That's what you said?
That is not true.
After that, have them read Jeff's book. Check this out. I thought you'd find this interesting, Chris. Yeah. There is a handy spookabulary in the book, right. A list of new words that every Halloween lover should know, as well as a monster manual featuring the unique creatures that serve the witch, compatible for the D&D 5th edition and Tiny D6 RPG systems.
Oh, I love Tiny D6, and of course, 5th ed is great.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Then he worked in that stuff to his book, which is a young adult book, and I do recommend that everybody check it out. All of which is a wind around to say Aichtober has finally entered the spookabulary of HP Podcraft. I really like that word, spookabulary.
Yeah.
So welcome back, folks.
Now, this story so far, our narrator, Mel, is a 40-year-old woman living back at home when her long-lost school friend, Sally, has come back into town after her father has died. Her father was a mysterious man that people didn't know much about. Sally seemed like her happy-go-lucky old self when they were first reunited, but Sally became distant and disheveled. After a strange interaction at a grocery store, Sally got hit by a car and is in hospital. The matron taking care of Sally, Mrs. Garvis, has asked Mel to check in on Sally's house. It seems that Mel is not just going to have a quick look around, but she is going to do some full-on snooping to figure out what the heck is going on with her friend.
So this will be the initial scenario for the Aichman tabletop role-playing game that I'm working on.
Oh, nice.
I think Dark Entries would be a good title for that.
What game mechanics does the game use?
What do you want to do?
I'm not sure. So according to what you've told me, this is a game where I go into my friends' houses after they've been hit by a car.
That's not in every game. No, that's this specific. Well, it's funny because I thought you might say something like, how many dice do I roll? And I'd go, it doesn't matter because, you know, it's Aichman and you're never going to learn anything. So I was going to try and play out that joke. But you said something so much funnier just now that the game is specifically going into your friend's houses after they got hit by a car. That's the game. That's the setup of the entire game.
Yeah.
And different scenarios that could play out as a result of that. I love it.
It's your idea. Of course you love it.
Well, we worked on that one together, I feel
okay.
Like. So in this scenario, your character is Mel. She's entering her friend Sally's house. And this is a drab former professional building.
Yes. As we heard at the top, there are a lot of keys, and they are abnormally large. Now, because Sally keeps all of these doors locked in this house, this is strange. And there's a second thing that she's noticed, that the teacups from a few weeks ago are still there. She hasn't cleaned them up. She finds the door at the end of the hall that doesn't seem to have any light in it. She can't turn it on because there doesn't seem to be a switch, but it smells stale and cold. And she thinks, is this Dr. Tesler's library? You know, the one that he always stayed at and never left. She decides that she's going to come back some other time and look.
Oh, if this is a movie, you would probably see that something's in there. And you would see her groping for the light, and it's right there. She's about to step in and she goes, I'll check this out later, and leaves. Now, I got, because it's from her perspective, you don't know that, right. But I definitely got that same feeling you would get from a scene like that. Like, she just narrowly avoided catastrophe of some kind.
Yeah. There's something about this character that's a little odd, too, because everything she's describing is so creepy and weird that her curiosity is unnaturally high. Because mm-hmm. this house is creepy. Everything she says about this house is creepy. You couldn't pay me to go there. I would say, you know what? Let the police look in my friend's house. I'm curious. Sure, I want to know what's going on with her. But there's something unnaturally weird about this place.
This game is going to fall flat. You're underselling the premise. No, you're wrong, Chris. Everybody's curious about what's going on in a friend's house, especially after they've been hit by a car.
Sure.
No, you say unnaturally curious, but I actually don't think so. Because remember, she has known her since they were children,
yeah,
and never gotten a bunch of essential details.
Upstairs, there are two rooms, one that just has a ton of papers in it, and the other a bedroom. Now, the bedroom has cheap furniture from about 20 years ago. So it's old and it was crappily made 20 years ago. The room is a mess, the bed is unmade, and there's some shabby underclothes lying about.
You know, in hoarders, there's always an area on the couch or the bed that the person sort of nests in as they're surrounded by all their mess.
Yeah.
This is that place. Yep. The first room has a considerable mass of papers covered in dust. It says the grime was of that ultimate kind, which seems to have an actual greasy consistency. Mm. I dig that Aikman goes a little further with the touch sensation. That was in the last story as well, when the turkey just slips right down.
Oh,
you.
God, yeah.
It's this viscosity that's so gross. Mm-hmm. And here, the fact that this is the paper so covered with grime that the grime is greasy. That's more effective than smell in a way. I don't know. It's not something you see a lot. The idea of further investigating those neglected masses of scroll and manuscript made me shudder. Of course, in the role-playing game, it's like, she made a roll. What do I decipher from it? And you would say, no, it would take you way too long to go through this.
You don't want to go through that.
If you want to stay here for a few hours, you can. No, I don't want to do that. I just won't find out.
Don't need to know. She does note that it seems that the door to the other room looks like it was at one time busted in and never fixed. She has to force her way in because the door is scraping on the floor. It has a bunch of old toys and seems to be an old nursery, but all of the toys there are woolly animals and they're rotten with mold. And the toys seem to be in pieces as well. Like, there's a teddy bear leg here and a fancy bird head over there. When were they ripped apart? When did that happen? Or was that part of, it could have been part of the natural disintegration of it, because it would just be in a pile. Parts wouldn't be strewn. So somebody had to rip these things apart and then just leave them there.
And leave the room.
Yeah. Mel wonders what the hell Sally's been doing this whole time, because she's definitely not cleaning the house.
No, but this room, like, we were positing all sorts of theories in the last one, but this is new weird information, right? Because I remember with Ooze, we were complaining because the significance of whether the wall fell in or out didn't seem, here it's significant. This door was broken from the inside out.
Yes.
It says it showed every sign of having been forcibly burst open and from the inside. Mm-hmm. So whatever was in here got out. That compared, you know, that with the fact that all the doors in the house being locked. Okay, so there's some monsters been living here or something. It's all, the toys are rotted, but like you say, they've not been rotted so much as to conceal the fact that at least some of them appeared also to have been mutilated.
Yeah.
Wow. So, you know, mutilated is the word that she uses. Very definite intent to the way that these things have been ripped apart. And they're all soft and woolly. Why? I don't know. There's no trucks or hard things, I guess, is the point. Nothing that could be used to scrape out a wall or break out of the room or hit somebody with.
Yeah. The implication might be that Sally was at one point put in there as a punishment of some kind, or there was another sibling that we never heard about.
Or another child of some kind. Now, remember, we don't know. We've got those evidence of those postcards that she traveled around, and it's what she said. But has she been in this house the entire time that she was supposedly gone?
But that,
you know, and that's when she was in. That doesn't make any sense.
Doesn't make any sense.
It's some other creature, I think.
It has. Well, because she would have been seen. And that was something I was thinking about, too, after our last show, is if her dad had to have been seen by somebody at some point, because people would then suspect that the house was empty. if he wasn't getting out and going, getting groceries or having groceries delivered or something like that.
But the grocery boy is seen later on in this story. So deliveries of groceries are happening.
Well, yeah.
So, you know, in the last 2 years, my neighbors don't know whether I'm here or not. They see DoorDash deliveries show up, but otherwise I haven't been out of this place at all. But I'm just in here doing the Colossus.
Sure. Somebody's got to be paying them, though, or they wouldn't keep delivering the groceries.
Well, in olden times, that's not how things worked. You know, you ever see in a movie, they'll be like, you got to pay that tab sometime. That's how everybody was with everything.
And it would go on for 25 yeah. years. Yes.
History, my friend.
Uh-huh.
Where are we with this? What's going on?
Mel's looking around to try and find a candle because she wants to see this dark room that she can't turn a light on. But she can't find a candle. She can't find a flashlight or anything. She knows that her dad's got one. So she's going to come back the next day with her dad's flashlight. And she thinks Sally might actually be on drugs. Like maybe that's why her behavior's been so strange, is that she's got, you know, hooked on some junk or something.
Yeah.
Which makes sense, actually.
It does make sense. Well, that's why this squalid world that we find in like Michael Shea works for horror so well, because in scenes like that, a crack house or some place where people are shooting heroin, occult happenings could easily go unnoticed because nothing makes sense in there anyway. Yeah. People who are on crystal meth will do very odd things and have very odd behaviors. And so you wouldn't know if there was an occult ritual that also happened. But there were a couple of details as Mel was leaving that were bothering me. Like, why are there no candles? Mm-hmm. You know, why is there no way to illuminate that room?
Yeah.
If it's being used by somebody, they would have to be cool with being in there in total darkness. And then also, she says, I eyed the collapsed front gate with new suspicion, you know, as she's leaving.
Uh-huh.
So did something totally get out of there? Or she says, sometime later, I realized I had relocked none of the inside doors. And man, that gave me the serious heebie-jeebies. I can't explain it, but it did.
Yeah. The next day, she goes back to the hospital to check on Sally. Miss Garvis says Sally is resting. She can't see anybody, which is a little odd, you know, because she hasn't seen Sally yet in the hospital. It just feels not quite right. She tells Mel that Sally has been emotionally upset, weeping, talking to herself, more hysterical than delirious.
They had to move her out of the big ward, she says. So one wonders if it was the noise of her freaking out, or did the things that she was saying upset the other patients?
Mm-hmm. We don't know.
Because of the nature of them. And she's following HIPAA, you know, she's protecting her patient's privacy by not relating what the patient is saying. She says it wouldn't be fair to our patients if he repeated what they say when they're not themselves. What does that mean?
Uh-huh.
I mean, does that get us back to this Charles Dexter ward kind of, she's in there going, I am sorry that I'm feeling a physical allow me to get to my carriage and I will quickly attend to the physics that I need. You know, is she just saying stuff like that?
That would be rad.
It's hard to know.
Well, we don't know.
Has she been replaced?
Miss Garvis asks when she checks on the house again if she would pick up a few things from Sally's house. And Mel agrees. And then she leaves.
Mel actually says she wanted to question me. She doesn't say what the outward indicator was of that. She states it as a fact.
Mm-hmm.
And then says she stopped herself and only asked everything in order. And Mel says, as far as I could see. So Miss Garvis knows something that would lead her to ask that particular question.
Yeah.
Everything in order. Which makes me think that she knows there might be something out in the house, or that she knows that that's what the Sally's screaming about.
Yeah. Or upset over whatever's going on with her might be related to the thing in the house. Now, Mel is getting obsessed over investigating this dark room. She goes and gets her father's flashlight and she heads up to the house.
In her self-conversation, she's saying, I'm more curious than afraid, and actually says, my fear was more fear of the unknown than of anything I imagined myself likely to find. And she says, I would have been glad to have a friend with me. It was a job for a man or for no one.
Uh-huh.
And I thought that was interesting. And just as a note, Aickman routinely writes female protagonists. This isn't a unique story for him. Mm-hmm. That's kind of cool. We don't see a lot of that. By the way, it's a dark and stormy day. It starts raining really hard. Mel's mother's like, why are you even bothering to go over there? She puts on her galoshes and her rain gear and she goes over with her flashlight. And when she enters, she leaves her things. It says her saturated beret. I just like the sound of that. She leaves all of her stuff close to the front door as if she knows she might have to make a hasty exit. It's an instinctive thing.
Now she finds a switch almost immediately in the room. It's at the right height, but it's all the way over in the middle of the wall. The switch is.
As if it were purposely there to keep it from being turned on by somebody at the door.
Yeah. Why?
Because I think it's something that lives in darkness. It's kind of like a haunter in the dark thing. That's why there were no candles. Or I think it feeds on fear. There's a lot of evidence that it feeds on fear, though.
So the room is done in stonework. It's got an arched ceiling. The stones look very haphazard, as if they were put in by somebody unskilled. So maybe somebody built this room out of necessity and they didn't want to hire an actual bricklayer to do it. The door is made of reinforced sheet of iron, which is bizarre. There's no window of any kind, heat or ventilation. So Mel thinks that maybe this was built for the air raids during the war?
Eh? She's trying to come up with something.
Something. There are some shelves and books, a desk, and another bed, which also looks like it's recently been occupied as well. So is Sally sleeping in two different spots, or is there someone else that's staying here? She looks under the pillow and finds Sally's pajamas. They're not folded, just kind of crammed in there. So it does seem that she has slept upstairs, but then she moved down into this dark cave-like library to sleep. So why? What's that about? Now, Mel considers that maybe Dr. Kessler was insane and that he was confined to this room, or maybe he confined himself.
There's this line. I would have thought if that were the case, it would be a padded room, but no room could be less padded than this one. That was a funny detail. It was much more like a prison.
Yeah.
And it says the room also, and horribly, resembled a tomb.
Mel tries to put all this together. Sally's strange behavior, the library, the locked doors, the broken door on the old nursery, and she comes up with nothing.
Nothing that she'll say. I mean, I got the sense that she came up with something. She says, I fought off the most probable solution. So there's some probable solution that she is fighting off in her brain, very Lovecraftily.
What is that?
The fact that more than an oubliette or a grave, the place resembled a fortress. There was something in the house against which protection was necessary, was imperative, it says. Mm-hmm. She's at least come up with an idea that there's something. That's why the doors were locked.
That's why that there, Sally has moved into this bunker, basically,
yeah,
to keep something away or at bay.
Whatever was up in the nursery busted out and it's around, but keep the doors locked, be up in this thing and it can't get to you.
Now she looks around the house and just to make sure she didn't leave anything amiss, but when she walks into the sitting room, for a split second, she sees a man.
Only for a moment, a second, a gleam, when in that almost vanished light I re-entered the sitting room, I saw him. As if for my benefit, to make the most of the little light, he stood right up in the big bay window. The view he presented to me was what I should call three quarters back, but I could see a fraction of the outline of his face, entirely white, a thing which has to be seen to be believed, and with the skin drawn tight over the bones as by a tourniquet. There was a suggestion of wispy hair. I think he wore black, a garment I thought like a frock coat. He stood, stooped and shadowy, except for the glimpse of white face. Of course, I could not see his eyes. Needless to say, he was gone almost as soon as I beheld him, but it would be inexact to say that he went quite immediately. I had a scintilla of time in which to blink. I thought at first that dead or alive it was Dr. Kessler, but immediately afterwards I thought not.
And that's the end of that section of story. We're out. We just are pulled out of that. And that was the part that, like, Max scared me, I have to say. I don't know why. I just got that sudden WTF rush of what is happening. I did not expect anybody to be standing there, although all indicators were that the place was haunted or occupied in some way.
Yes.
It still surprised me. And then it's just this little bit of detail here and out. And what was that?
Don't know.
Why immediately afterwards did she think, no, that wasn't the doctor? Was it the occupant of that room up there? What about the all-white tourniquet face?
And what does she mean when he was there and he wasn't there? Was he there in a sense of, like, she thought she saw a person standing there and then her eyes adjusted and she realized, oh no, I didn't see a person standing there? Or was somebody there and they moved in a fast fashion and she lost track of them?
We've got a lot of description of footsteps going up and down stairs and that kind of thing, so you would think it would be mentioned. It just felt like it appeared and that she blinked. And that it had,
like, it was an illusion almost that she
saw. Right, but that it had, you know, the way if you look at a light, you can still see it a second later. I got that impression from it. So it was like so quick, but there was a little bit of a fade of some kind. There's a ghost sighting, you know, but it's just so unique in the way it's presented.
Now she rushes home and confides in her father about the whole situation, leaving out some of the details. And her father basically tells her, look, it's none of your business.
Which just could be his point of view of the world, but it does say he seems unusually serious. So I feel like he probably is clued into some townspeople talk that even she doesn't know about.
She tries to defend herself, saying that she's helping a friend, but her dad points out that you were just supposed to pick up the mail, not nosy around.
This was mentioned at the top of the month about being really the truth that it seems this author's getting to, and here it's just right out in the open. He says, the dad says, haven't you noticed by this time that everyone's lives are full of things you can't understand? The exceptional thing is the thing you can understand. I remember a man I knew when I was first in London. He broke off. But fortunately, we don't have to understand. And for that reason, we've no right to scrutinize other people's lives too closely. Now, for one, he was just about to tell her the story of Dracula. I'm positive. When I first moved in London, there was this old Jonathan Harker. You got to get a load of this. But, I mean, I love that he just put his overarching theme right in there. The lives of others may as well be supernatural things because they are equally incomprehensible to us. The good thing is we don't really need to know.
No. And she's a bit taken aback by her father because he's always like this really nice, gregarious guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just telling her, mind your own business. It's just not normally the kind of thing he would say. So she doesn't know what to do with this information. She just goes up to bed. And then she remembers that she totally forgot to pick up Sally's things, the whole reason she was going to the house.
Yeah, those rather pathetic undergarments she mentioned. There was something funny in her conversation with her father, too, that, I mean, it was legit funny to me, where he said, you know, you can always see things in the half light. So she must have told him about the image that she saw.
Yeah.
He goes, especially an artistic girl like you, you know, you could have just created something out of it. And she said even from her parents, she liked being called a girl still. That was funny because it's like, you know, if somebody says, oh, you know, you remind me of a young whomever, you'll go, I'm just glad you called me young. I don't care what the second part is. You know, it was that kind of a joke. So I liked.
So the next day she apologized to Mrs. Garvis, who is a bit confused at to how she could forget to do the one thing that she was supposed to do at the house. Strangely, Mrs. Garvis decides to drop her professional ethos and drop some information, some confidential information about Sally.
Right. She tells another word. Can you leave the room and give us some space? I'm going to drop some confidential information. And in the narrative, it says, I smiled. Confidences pre-announced are seldom worthwhile. Mel is a little sarcastic. Also, I just realized, you know, when I was reading that another reason she's not getting the full picture is because she doesn't like Miss Garvis very much.
Yeah.
For whatever reason. So that's preventing sharing of info. Well, get ready, Mel, because she is about to drop something on you.
Yeah. It seems Sally is pregnant and the baby is unharmed from this accident that Sally's had. But Sally is in this mental state. She's really upset. Miss Garvis asks if Mel would consider letting Sally stay with her after she gets out. But Mel explains she's been trying to get her to move in with her already and she won't do it. So Miss Garvis asks if she knows who the father is. She doesn't say no. She says, I said nothing. Why that phrasing? Does she know who the father is?
I don't think she knows, but I think she's got speculations just like we do. And she just did. It's not worth saying anything if you don't have any information. So I think, and also I think her speculations would be pretty crazy. Like it might be a all white tourniquet face guy kind of looks like Rorschach without the ink. I don't know. But this also, Miss Garvis says there are things about the pregnancy I don't like. And now this could be because if you think, you know, Sally's 40 years old at least, right?
Yeah.
You can get pregnant at that age, but that is odd. But I sense she means something else. And then, well, I mean, also she got in a car accident and the baby's still okay. And Miss Garvis says it's nothing less of a miracle of one kind or another.
Now, Mel doesn't want to go back to the house to get Sally's few things that she was supposed to get. But she feels like she must. She doesn't even think about the pregnancy. She focuses on the fact that she's got to go into this really creepy house where she saw the ghost guy. Maybe she could burn it down. She's considering this. This is something she's like, well, this might be an option. Just burn the whole house down.
Yeah.
Maybe Mel could just leave town. That's another thing she thinks. I could just get out of here and not deal with it at all. But she feels like she can't abandon Sally, so she does decide to go into the house.
And aside from burning it down, she also thinks exorcism? Or maybe I just leave town entirely and don't deal with it at all. So that's the scariest. I mean, it's that bad.
While going there, she's still thinking about burning down the house. Like, she hasn't let this side plan go. She hasn't dismissed it entirely. And she thinks, well, would it burn? Because there's a lot of stonework in there, so it might actually catch fire. And then, of course, what about the neighbors? She doesn't want that house to catch the neighbor's house on fire. She doesn't want anybody to get hurt. She just wants to stop this darkness.
Right, and it's not hyperbole when she's thinking about burning it down or leaving. And she also thinks about that stack of papers upstairs. She thinks, well, maybe I could figure out what's going on if I read that. Even though there's thing on the doorstep and Dunwich Horror things going on in the story, it's also a lot like the music of Eric Zahn, where I feel like the real weird tale is actually up in that stack of papers in the room that she commented on and then didn't read. If you'll remember in Eric Zahn, there was a stack of papers on the desk that probably also contained the real weird tale and they all blew out the window.
Oh, right,
so it's that idea of something happened. It is documented. There is an explanation. But for this story, we're going to take the point of view of somebody who's so outside of it in order to create that much more mystery. Yeah. It's very similar to Lovecraft to me, I think, a lot of this stuff.
Yeah. Now, when she gets to the front of the house, she feels sick. She really doesn't want to go inside. She notices the grocery delivery boy staring at her from across the street. He looks petrified. His mouth is open and his eyes are wide. Mel thinks he's maybe surprised at the fact that she's going to go in the house for some reason. But why would he be that shocked by that? That's, Mel pulls it together and doesn't want to look bad in front of this kid. So she goes inside.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because this kid's standing over there looking shocked. And she goes, it's because of me. It's the way I look or the way, the silly way I'm conducting myself. I better just get inside and stop freaking this kid out. And when I think about, I'd look around and go, what is he reacting to? It's not me.
It's not me.
There's probably some monster just standing in the window with, knife and fork waiting for her to walk in. And that's what he's freaking out about.
She goes down to the kitchen and gets herself a glass of water to calm her nerves. But then she hears footsteps coming down the stairs. And that is just too much for her. And she faints.
I came round to the noise of an animal, a snuffling, grunting cry, which seemed to come with much persistence from the floor above. I seemed to listen to it for some time, even trying, though failing, to identify what animal it was, before recovering more fully and realizing that Sally was leaning back against the dresser and staring at me.
She's surprised that Sally's there, and Sally is pissed. Sally also seems off, like her voice is strange and kind of gravelly, and her eyes have a repulsive lifelessness.
The bone structure of her face had altered unbelievably. Dressed in a very curious way, of which I do not think it is fair to say more. God damn you.
Why not? Sally demands her keys back. Mel gets up quickly, but realizes that she might be hurt from her fall, from passing out. Mel tells Sally that she's glad that she's better, but didn't expect to see her so soon. And Sally says nothing and just stretches out a bony hand for the keys.
Which, how did she get in without the keys? One might wonder. Mel wonders that. Look, she locked the front door. Was she always already in there and there's another Sally at the hospital? I was thinking, I don't know. We could talk about that after.
Yeah. So Mel gives her the keys. But this animal upstairs is still making this noise. And Mel thinks that it might be a pig, this rutting noise thing that's going on upstairs. So she looks up at the ceiling and Sally snatches the keys out of her hand. And then she looks up at the ceiling because she realizes Mel notices there's something upstairs. And she starts to laugh.
Do you love children, Mel? Would you like to see my baby? Truly, it was the last straw. And I do not know quite how I behaved. Now Sally seemed filled with terrible pride. Let me tell you, Mel, she said, that it's possible for a child to be born in a manner you'd never dream of. I had begun to shudder again, but Sally clutched hold of me with her grey hand and began to drag me up the basement stairs. Will you be godmother? Come and see your godchild, Mel. The noise was coming from the library. I clung to the top of the basement baluster. Distraught as I was, I now realized that the scrabbling sound was connected with the tearing to pieces of Dr. Tesla's books. But it was the wheezy, throaty cry of the creature which most turned my heart and sinews to water.
Oh!
What?
Dude, I don't know what's going on. This is crazy. What does she mean? A child may be born in a manner you've never dreamed of.
I don't know. And is that connected to the Petronius thing that she had told her when they were young?
I don't know. And then what is upstairs? And how did she get out of the hospital? Because Mel was at the hospital yesterday. How did she get out that quickly? We don't know. This is all really bizarre. Anyway, Mel finds the strength to bust away because Sally's actually quite weak. When she pulls away from her, she realizes she's not very strong. And she pushes past Sally to get to the front door. Sally scratches Mel's face and her neck. And it says this, Sally then began to call out in her unnatural voice. She was trying to summon the creature into the passage. She scraped and tore at me while panting out a stream of dreadful endearments to the thing in the library. Mel defends herself and then puts her hands around Sally's throat and then throws her to the ground as she just runs out of the house. How does Mel deal with this? Does she go to the police? No. She leaves town for 2 weeks.
Good decision, Mel. I don't blame you.
Handle that. But Christmas is getting close, so she eventually has to go back to her parents' house. She wants nothing to do with Sally. She finds out from Mrs. Garvis that Sally just disappeared from the hospital one day. She was never discharged.
Miss Garvis, it says, is very suspicious of her involvement. It's like she thinks that Mel had something to do with Sally's disappearance.
Now, Mel notes that no one in town really noticed or cared that Sally was gone. Then, one day between Easter and Whitsun, this is months later, Sally shows up at Mel's front door. She looked like her old self. She looked normal, like that first time that she saw her after her father died. And she's just chatting up a storm. She has her sweet smile back. She's pretty again. She tells Mel that she sold the house, and she said that she's bought a villa in the Cyclades Islands, and that's in the Aegean Sea near Greece. The house sold for way more than she expected.
Already she was lying on the big sofa and looking at me over the arm. Mel, I should like you to come and stay with me for a long time, as long as you can. You're a free agent, and you can't want to stay here. Psychologists, I recollected, have ascertained that the comparative inferiority of women, in context described as purely intellectual, is attributable to the greater discouragement and repression of their curiosity when children. Thank you, Sally, but I'm quite happy here, you know. You're not, are you, Mel? No, I'm not. Well then, one day, I shall probably go.
Wow, and that's the end.
We started with, no, so you didn't want to forget it. We started with that quote
yeah.
by the princess. Mm-hmm. Every woman secretly wants to be taken advantage of. And we end with the psychologist's recollected conclusion from the narrator that basically women are discouraged from being curious when they're children. And so they grow up still scared to be too curious, mm-hmm. which as we've seen was an obstacle throughout the story that perhaps they were being too demure to really get to the bottom of what was going on. Maybe that's what the comment is meant.
But what the F is going on?
Is it Sally who's being taken advantage of by her father? Is that what that quote's about? Or is it is the princess wrong in what she's saying?
Yeah.
And that's being illustrated here, you know? Lots to think about,
Is
man.
Mel being taken advantage of?
Well, why does she want her to come live with her at the end?
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of questions. There's a lot to think about, many layers to this. And I know it seems a little random. And I could see somebody having an argument like, this is just a bunch of nonsense.
No, it's not, though.
But it's not.
No,
feels like not. This is very deliberate and there is something going on. And there is a feeling that Aickman is trying to convey, which he does so expertly. Because I think I'm feeling exactly what he wants me to feel when I'm reading this story.
Yeah. No, that argument holds no water. You can say, I don't like this kind of thing. And definitely there are people who write things that are obscure just to be obscure. But this is not that. I loved it. I mean, it was really frightening. Lack of conclusions in here are what make this incredibly unsettling. It doesn't mean that lack of conclusions always lead to that. It has to be done in the right way. And Aickman clearly shows that he's the guy. I mean, there's a reason that so many people are fans of this writer because he does that really well. And I don't know, you know, maybe the ghost of the dad was impregnating her. Is there more than one girl, you know, because her appearance, her facial structure being different and stuff? Yeah. Was the creature that was in the house another her?
A twin sister?
Does she give birth to a repeating version of herself or something? Or like, what? I don't know, man.
Who knows?
Did she really escape the hospital and come back?
I don't know. But what really sticks with me, the fact that Mel is willing to kind of just forget all these things that have happened and go be friends with her and go live in the Aegean Sea. Like, that's sort of an interesting commentary on people and relationships and friendships, that your friends can do some really effed up stuff to you. And you'll just kind of go, well, mostly they're good. And I'm going to forget these messed up things that they did or hurtful things they said or whatever. I feel like there's a bit of that going on in this as well, that people just sort of forgive really strange things that maybe they shouldn't forgive in their relationships.
Yeah.
Just to be in that relationship.
Why will she probably go? Why does she say that at the end?
Because she probably will, because she's got nothing else going on.
Yeah.
She wants to be free, and she knows that she can get that freedom with Sally. Super interesting in a lot of different ways to look at it.
It's such a cool story, man. I really liked it a lot.
Well, we'll be coming back to Aickman for sure, and I don't know if we'll wait till next year or not, but definitely Swords is one we got to read because of that. I love that story. And then there's a few. I bought all of his collections. I physically now have print copies of everything that Aickman wrote. Not that there's that much, but...
You're an Aickmaniac.
I am an Aickmaniac. I can't help it. It's great stuff. I want to thank Rachel Lackey for bringing this creepy, creepy stuff to life. She is a very talented woman and a great podcaster. Check her out on Rachel Watches Star Trek.
Thank you so much, Rachel. I would also like to thank some patrons. And I'm going to start by thanking John Fiala.
I'd like to thank Michael J. Brugman.
Simon J. Hedge. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew J. Pine.
Boy, everybody's got the middle initial J this time.
Oh, wow.
Wonder if they're related. Paul Cornelius, I'd like to thank you.
Sam Harris, thank you so much.
Bag of Coins, I'd like to thank.
You know, people don't carry coins around in bags anymore. That's something
they don't.
I'm really sad about. I'd like to thank Jennifer.
I'd like to thank Ian Dobson.
And lastly, Joshua Levesque, thank you so much.
And that's all we've got for this month of October. And I hope you all have a happy Halloween. It's the best time of the year, so enjoy it. That's all we've got for Strange Studies of Strange Stories. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and we're at hppodcraft.com and Patreon.
hppodcraft.com.